This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. If you're new to the Everything Financial Radio Podcast, we produce two podcasts each week talking about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your money. Also, each week we interview a special guest expert. Joining me on the podcast this week is best-selling author Harry Dent. I had the pleasure of talking with Harry this past week, and my recorded conversation with him will air this week on the podcast. We also offer some free resources to our podcast listeners. If you've not yet requested your free Investor's Discovery Kit, you can get an Investor's Discovery Kit for free by simply visiting our website, investingapproach.com. The website, again, investingapproach.com. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is the author of The Demographic Cliff. He's also the editor of the free newsletter, The Economy and Markets. We'll get more about the book momentarily. Harry is the author of several best-selling books, and you've probably seen him on television commenting on the markets. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, nice to be back, Dennis.
Harry, when you take a look at what's happened recently in the stock markets, one can only think of one term, and that is volatility. Where's all this going?
Well, you know, I think something important happened. We have always said when bubbles, you know, burst. They don't correct. And China just saw a 35% crash in a little over 3 weeks. And it would have been much more than that if the government in China hadn't stepped in with tens and tens of billions of dollars to prop up the market, and they're still doing that. I think this is the beginning of the end, that we've been saying China is the biggest bubble in modern history. It has the largest real estate bubble by far of any major country in the world. China has overbuilt, you know, just tens and tens and tens of millions of empty condos and then empty whole cities and then infrastructures and empty malls and office buildings. I mean, China has consistently for the last 10 to 30 years, really for 30 years, but especially in the last 10 to 12, has just overbuilt everything and created a huge bubble, moved, you know, hundreds of millions of people with no skills from rural areas into urban areas, and now they're trapped in these cities. And so that we've been saying China's going to be the biggest trigger for the next crash, because it's something that the Federal Reserve and the ECB can't really do anything about. If that bubble blows, the Chinese have so much of their wealth. They save way more than we do, 50% for the average person, 70% for the top 10% of people in that country. They save way more money than us, and they put almost all of it in real estate, whereas we put it more in stocks and bonds. So that real estate bubble is going to cause an implosion of wealth, and China's going to go down hard. So we've been waiting for a sign, and this stock market crash was the first sign. We've also seen, I think, Germany's market has topped. It's now 10% off its highs. Germany is supposedly holding up Europe, and yet we know a dirty secret nobody knows, that we knew about the Japanese in the late 80s. They have the worst demographic trends of any country in the world over the next 8 years. And so you know, to see Germany starting to crack, Greece coming back into, you know, default or near default, you know, I think things are just starting to happen, and I think that central banks are going to lose control of the economy. They've been able to prop it up and keep pumping money and keep the markets going up, but I think we've been saying ultimately something will go wrong, and then this major bubble around the world in stock and in real estate will burst, and it will be much bigger than 2008.
So, Harry, let's go back and just comment a little bit on China. There was, Kissinger still is a saying that the United States sneezes, economically speaking, and the world catches a cold. Wouldn't that be true of China now with their economy? When you look at it on a purchasing power parity basis, their economy is about the size of the U.S. from the information I've read. What effect will this bubble bursting in China have on the United States and the rest of the world?
Well, it's huge, Dennis, and the biggest impact will not be on us, but on emerging countries. We've been saying for years that the stealth crisis that nobody's been talking about hasn't just been the bubbles in real estate and stocks and all this printing money. It's been the steady fall of commodity prices. China is not only the second largest economy in the world, it's the fastest growing by far. It's grown as high as 10 to 12% and supposedly 7% recently, even though I don't believe those figures. But accounts for 40 to 50% of the industrial and energy kind of commodities in the world. So they're this massive manufacturing machine, and when they slow down, commodity prices go down, and when commodity prices go down, emerging countries go down. Brazil's stock market is down 60%. The emerging markets index is down like 40% from the top and about to break some important support. So it'll have a huge impact on emerging countries and their growth. And the second thing is that China's wealthy are leading. They're trying to get their money. I mean, almost all these people trying to move out of China, they don't trust their government. They don't trust the bubble there. And they know they're going to get hit when it happens. So what they do is they say, hey, guess what? We're moving to California. We're moving to London. We're moving to Vancouver to get our kids in a good English-speaking college or university. And what they're really doing is buying the most expensive real estate they can find in those cities to launder their money and get it out of their country, because legally they can only pull $50,000 in cash. But, of course, nobody's going to tell you when you move to San Francisco that you can't buy a condo or a home. So they're driving this real estate bubble around the world. And boy, I mean, the same thing happened in the early 90s when the Japanese, they were the rich up-and-coming country back then that was growing, and they had a real estate bubble, and they used the wealth from that real estate bubble to buy real estate everywhere else. So the Chinese are doing the same thing. So we're going to see domino effect of real estate markets going down when the China bubble first. So China, you're right, I mean, is number one indicator we're watching. We say the stock market's going to keep crashing in the next several months, and then at some point their economy is going to slow down substantially, and then their real estate bubble is going to burst, and then it's game over globally.
So, Harry, when you take a look at this, and let's expand on this, and let me just remind the listeners, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Harry Dent, and Harry is the author of The Demographic Cliff. He's also the editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets. And Harry, we've got about 2 minutes, a little bit more than that left. When you say that China's real estate bubble is likely going to burst, and it looks like maybe that has started, do you think that the United States real estate market is due for an encore performance of what we saw about 10 years ago?
Yes. I think we're going to see another crash. I've studied bubbles up and down, and we got a whole chapter on it in the book, Chapter 5. But bubbles not only always burst, but when they burst, they tend to go back to where the bubble started or a bit lower than that. The real estate bubble started in January of 2000 when the tech bubble peaked and started to fall off. And our real estate went up 1.3 times, okay, 130%. China's real estate since that time has gone up 680%. Great. I mean, makes our bubble look like nothing. So China's got a lot farther to fall, but so do we. Just to go back to January of 2000, when the bubble started, we would have to see real estate down 55% from the top. It only went down 34% in the last correction, so we've got a lot more to go. I think real estate is going to fall 40% from where it is now, and it is going to end up being 55, maybe 65% down to the top. This is going to leave a lot of people with negative equity, as we saw in, you know, after 2008. Only this is going to be much more this time. So it's when a real estate bubble bursts, it's much worse than a stock bubble. You know, because we had the tech bubble burst in early 2000. All we had was a very minor recession. This is going to cause a depression, the deepest downturn we've seen since the 1930s, because, you know, mortgages fail when housing prices goes down, and banks fail, and then people get trapped in their house and underwater in their negative their equity. So this is serious stuff.
I will be continuing my conversation with our special guest this week, best-selling author Harry Dent, on the second podcast this week. You know, this past week, the Federal Reserve, or to be more accurate, the Federal Open Market Committee, met and elected not to raise interest rates once again, as we have been talking about here on the Everything Financial Radio program for some time. And I want to give you just a bit from their July 29 press release. In that press release, it begins by saying, information received since the Federal Open Market Committee met in June indicates that economic activity has been expanding moderately in recent months. Growth in household spending has been moderate, and the housing sector has shown additional improvement. However, business fixed investment and net exports stayed soft. Let's look at the areas that did well, according to the Fed's press release. The housing sector was one area that the Fed said was strong. Going back to what we talk about when we discuss the concept of economic seasons, housing is doing well because housing is really debt-driven consumption. A couple months ago here on the program, I talked about the fact that there was an article published in the Wall Street Journal titled The Return of the 3% Mortgage, the Return of the 3% Down Mortgage. Little or no money down mortgages are back, makes it easier for folks to buy homes. In fact, when you take a look at the level of debt that is now being added in the housing sector, we believe that this is purely a debt-driven area of consumption. The other area that the Fed says is doing quite well is household spending. Again, debt-driven consumption. Now, there is a Reuters article that was published this past week, actually one day after the Fed's press release came out. And the Reuters article began by talking about the fact that U.S. economic growth accelerated in the second quarter as solid consumer spending offset the drag from weak business spending on equipment. That is actually right out of the Fed's press release. The article says that suggests that the Federal Reserve could be closer to hiking interest rates this year. I will go on record as saying that they will not do it in September, as many are predicting. I have made that same prediction earlier this year, as a lot of analysts said that the Fed would raise rates by summer. Well, now that's not happening, and I predict that won't happen in September either for reasons that I will talk about. What I really want to focus on, though, is the measure of economic growth, because the Reuters article talks about the fact, and I'm quoting again from the article, gross domestic product expanded at a 2.3% annual rate. That's according to the Commerce Department. First quarter GDP, or gross domestic product, previously was reported as to have shrunk at a 0.2% pace, was now revised to show that it was rising at a 0.6% rate. Now, why did this revision happen? Why did the reported level of economic growth go from negative economic growth or contraction to positive economic growth, even though it was only a 0.6% rate? But that's a big swing. Why did this happen? Well, there was a blog written by Mr. Dave Kranzier that I thought did a nice job explaining this. And I am going to give you a bit of a paraphrase from Mr. Kranzier's writing here. He started by saying, I guess the new policy regarding the presentation of economic data that has been implemented by the government is if you don't like the way data is reported, you change the way data is reported, or you change the methodology by which you gather the data. He continues by saying, after all, the media will zero in on the newly fabricated statistics, rather strong language, and that will become the Orwellian truth. Besides, the public doesn't care. Now, you know something has changed by the government when the press release announcing the results contains several paragraphs explaining how the revisions work. Now, let me give you an example of this press release. A new aggregate, in other words, a new metric, a new measuring stick, the average of GDP and GDI is a supplemental measure of U.S. economic activity. In real or inflation-adjusted terms, this measure increased 0.5% in the first quarter of 2015. So that's how this 0.2% real decline in GDP is now considered to be a 0.6% gain. Now, when you look at the other data, it's hard to figure out how there was really an economic gain in the first quarter. In fact, when you take a look at factory orders and retail sales, which make up the majority of gross domestic product, and when you think about factory orders and retail sales, another way to talk about that is manufacturing and consumption. Those are the two components of gross domestic product, except for government spending. Well, factory orders have been declining since early to mid-2014, and they've declined to levels not seen since 2008 at the financial crisis. When you look at consumption, the year-over-year retail sales number also declined. So if those two numbers declined, how can you possibly have negative economic growth or consumption revised to show that there was actually economic growth? And the answer is that the metric is changed. The metric has changed. This has happened time and time again whenever economic data doesn't look as good as maybe someone would like it to look. The unemployment rate has changed significantly over the years. I should say the way the unemployment rate is calculated has changed significantly over the years. It used to be if you were working part-time but wanted to work full-time, you were considered to be unemployed. You were counted among those who were unemployed. If you weren't working, you were considered to be unemployed. Now, if you've quit looking for a job because you're frustrated, you're no longer counted as part of the labor force, and that makes the reported unemployment rate look better. The same is true about the way the inflation rate is calculated. In fact, Mr. Kranzier discusses that in his article as well. He says the reason the government wants to present a decline in its GDP, its gross domestic product deflator, is that it has the mathematical effect of converting real gross domestic product into a higher number than nominal. So if the inflation-adjusted gross domestic product is lower, real GDP or real economic growth will be reported as higher. I know this is confusing, but understanding the reality of what's going on in the economy and the reality of what might be happening in the markets, we believe is key to managing your nest egg properly in the months and years ahead. We do offer some additional free resources if you'd like to take advantage of them. One of those resources is our free Investors Discovery Kit, which can be yours by visiting the website investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. Just let us know your name and where you'd like us to mail your free Investors Discovery Kit, and we'll be glad to do that. That concludes our first podcast for this week. Tune in again in just a couple days for our conversation again with Mr. Harry Dent. Bye.